Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, psychic, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio television talk show personality. She brings to the airwaves talented people from around the world who share their insights and experiences with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to an hour of Mind Power. This is Donna Sebo. And today we're going to be talking business. Mind and business go hand in hand. You cannot be in life on any level without understanding you are in business, if nothing else, in business for yourself. Today's world is a very complex world. Is that anything new? I don't think so. But we're dealing with issues today that require a thought processing that I think has been abandoned. My guest today, William Cohen, has put together a book about a man by the name of Mr. Drucker. Who is Mr. Drucker? Why is he significant? Why did he have such an impact in his lifetime on so many people? What was exceptional about this man's thinking? This and more we're going to be discussing with Mr. Cohen. But I think it's so important, this book, The Practical Drucker, applying the wisdom of the world's greatest management thinker. It's more than just business protocols. It's about protocols for life and how you live life and how you demonstrate your life on so many levels. I want to welcome to the airwaves William Cohen. Thank you for being my guest today.
Thank you so much, Donna, and just please call me Bill.
Oh, good. I just love to do that.
Okay,
Bill, you are the president of the California Institute of Advanced Management. You have been in the Air Force. In fact, you were a general. You've been in executive positions throughout many different companies. You've even been the president of two universities. Do you ever have time for a cup of coffee and a donut, for heaven's sake?
Well, I'm gonna sip my coffee here this morning. But
there we
yes,
go. Okay. So radio interviews give you that opportunity. All right, that's a good thing. Seriously, though, here we are in a climate in the United States. This isn't the first time it's happened either, where there's so much distrust. There is so much going on. It's almost as if we have these repetitive cycles every once in a while where there has to be, and this is going to sound a little, well, weird, but it's as if we have to throw up and throw out the noxious aspects of, let's say, in a political environment, business environment. We have to clean up our act. Maybe that's even a better way. But you have to bring things up and out so that they can be seen. Mr. Drucker was a man that wasn't afraid to do this. Tell us about how you became aware of him, and why was it that he had such an impact on you?
Well, I, as you mentioned, I was in the Air Force, and I have to go all the way back now and quickly tell you that I had left the Air Force briefly. My wife is an Israeli, and I went to Israel for 3 years. And when I returned, I actually grew up in a military family. So I knew absolutely nothing about business or anything else, but I had to find a job. And I was managed to do that, and the first name I came across was Peter Drucker. And I realized, and even this was in the 70s, by the way, Donna, but even then he had been writing for some years, was really renowned as, even at that time, as a father of modern management. Because before Peter came along, you know, you go to a bookstore, there may be one or two books on management or business. But nowadays, you know, there are bookshelves and bookshelves, and they say this is all due to Peter Drucker. So, anyway, that was my first exposure to him. Was I? Pardon me. The company I work with was well aware of him, and they used his book, one of his main books, as their guidelines. And that was my first exposure.
I was on the phone with someone yesterday who is working for a huge, huge company. It's like a bureaucracy, and they were so distressed. This individual which is a female, is very much, very sophisticated in business, and she is watching something happening with this company that she's worked with for so long. One of the components that's evolving is they're throwing away people of experience, and that's literally what they're doing. They're removing them, and they're bringing in a lot of people that have no experience and that maybe they've just come fresh out of college, and they might have just gotten an A-plus in business management and writing papers, but they have no clue about being involved in running a business. And it distressed her. This was just yesterday. It distressed her deeply, and we had a conversation, and it was all about change and how important change is and adaptability. We're living in a world that's filled with technology. But when it comes to dealing with people, there is an attitude of throwing the baby out with the bathwater, as far as I'm concerned. I know that's an old adage, but it really is a good description. Instead of throw the dirty water out, keeping the baby, keeping things healthy, it's like, well, we'll just shuck everything. I have been told by many people, they're very distressed with business schools because they're finding that so many that come out of the schools just assume they're going to be able to step into important positions and do different things. And they really, they just don't have it. They don't know, understand this about what a business really is. And one of the first things that you bring out in your book is the ethics of, I'll use your term, social responsibility. But how can we deal with this? We have seen on such a scale, our own government, $600 million plus in a system, that why didn't somebody consult Amazon or one of these other companies that are dealing, you know, USP, you know, the FedEx or someone else? What is it? Why? What goes on here? How can we get around this, Bill? How can we take care of this?
Well, pardon me. Let me start by saying that Peter Drucker said that the purpose of an organization is really to enable ordinary people to do extraordinary things. And when I became a student and got to know him, I realized how much he meant by this and what a genius he was. And he realized that there would be people errors and so forth going through. But the essence is of is the ethics of doing things right. And his notion of social responsibility wasn't at every company or every organization. In fact, I have to say that he spent the last 15 years of life of his life, and he lived till he was practically 96, 2 weeks short of his 96th birthday. But he said that the last 15 years he spent totally on nonprofit organizations. And he said that the businesses have to focus on people, that these were really their strengths. In fact, he was one of the first management writers, the first writer and business writer, management writer, whatever you want to call him, to say that people had to be considered on the positive side of the account sheet, not the negative. They weren't a cost. They were a benefit. Mm-hmm. And one of the things he wrote about before his death was the fact that all businesses have to consider their employees as volunteers, because except in extremis, in other words, almost a depression that we're in right now, people can go elsewhere. And even now, mm-hmm. if people are very dissatisfied, they can move elsewhere. So they really have to be considered as volunteers and treated first. People have to come really before many other things, certainly before dollars and cents in the long run. So there were many innovative things that are quite different, and the reason for some of the problems that we're having today, both in our economy, which, by the way, he predicted 40 years ago that this was going to happen.
Amazing.
For two different reasons. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. This was something that was quite interesting about how he said that pay attention now because we're on a train that's going down a track, and we're going to derail. It's going to happen big time. You cannot continue to do certain patterns and expect that you're going to get good results. It's just not going to happen. And when I went through your book, I was just so thoughtful about so many components. And one of them is a statement, an engaged worker. And the definition is an engaged worker is one who is committed to contributing to the organization and is willing to exert extraordinary effort in accomplishing tasks important to the achievement of the organization's goals. And this complements what you've just said, but that having a satisfied worker does not create an engaged worker. Tell us
why. Yeah, that's absolutely true. Sure. Yeah, to be engaged is quite different than being satisfied. You hit quite a bit the surveys that people do all the way to see whether people are satisfied or not. And see, he said you can learn something from these surveys, but it's grossly insufficient because you really want people to be as volunteers, as engaged as anyone in the organization, right up to the president. And that president can't expect those that work with him or for him in some fashion to be more engaged than he is himself. In other words, a leader in any organization can't simply say, okay, guys, give him a nice pep talk and so forth, and then he leads, he or she. And he just says, okay, guys, go get him, and off he goes. No, he has to be as engaged as they are. Now, if he or she is, then and only then can he start building an organization in which everyone over the organization is working for the same goals. pardon me. I think most good leaders that have engaged organizations, you can really see the difference. And even in these difficult times right now, you can see some that are really prospering. As a matter of fact, I mean, it's amazing to me when I go to a restaurant, and some restaurants I've seen are very, very, all of them are pressed right now because of the recession. Mm-hmm. But some are actually increasing their sales, or actually moving out. And that's true in all businesses. And actually at all organizations. I mean, we see this some organizations. I mean, you mentioned the fact that difficulties we're having right now with the healthcare. But and that's true. But there's a lot of different organizations that have started things and they're doing just fine and they're doing great. So it really depends on the organizational managers and the leaders of the organization. They're responsible for, as I said earlier, of an organization's purpose being to have ordinary people actually not only do extraordinary things, but become extraordinary themselves.
One of the people that inspired Peter Drucker was from history, and I love history. And this is something I thought, this was a very wise man. He did not presume that he knew it all. He said, who can I examine? Who can I observe? And Confucius was one. But he was thoughtful about it. He just didn't take on the banner of someone from the past because he thought that was the best. What he did was take out what I consider the gold nuggets from each of those special leaders. And I find it so interesting that one of his greatest inspirations was a military leader who was, in the beginning, a junior officer, part of a 10,000-man Greek army who had been asked by Cyrus the Younger to feed his brother in the 4th century. This is an interesting story. Who is this person, and why was this individual so significant to Drucker?
Yeah, you're talking about Xenophon, of course, and it was really an amazing thing because being a military guy and being involved in organizations most of my life, leadership is always been something of great importance. And he made the statement in class one time that the first systematic book on leadership, and still the best, he said, was written by Xenophon. And that was 2,000 years ago. Pardon me. Now, I didn't even know who Xenophon was in those days. But it turns out, as you indicated, Xenophon was a general. And he did lead this Greek army of 10,000 all the way back home after they'd been running some very severe problems. But Xenophon was also a writer and a historian, and he used Cyrus the Great also as an example of what could be done as a leader. I mean, he read several books, and Drucker recommended both of them. And the books that Drucker that indicated the first you just mentioned, which was translated in English as our trip uptown or upstate or whatever, but it meant it was a huge, huge, huge journey where these Greeks survived, and he brought them back after all their generals had been massacred. He was elected as general and managed to get them back, and he did a lot of things. But he also wrote a book called The Education of Cyrus the Great. Now, Cyrus the Great was a Persian, and Cyrus had lived 200 years earlier, so I think his book was much along the lines of the individual that wrote the bestseller about, who was it, the Leadership Secrets who was the great Hun leader? I forget right now. I guess I haven't had enough of this coffee. I was talking. Yeah, Attila, of course. Attila the Hun. And I think so. I think he probably was using it as a metaphor. But he was asked one time someone wanted to hire him to give a seminar on leadership. And at that time, he maintained, he says, look, there's nothing new that the ancients didn't know. And he was talking again about Xenophon. And in this case here, he mentioned the fact that Xenophon's book, he talked about Cyrus the Great. When Cyrus was a young man, a teenager, his father, who was raising him, said, what's the best way to get men to obey you? And the young Cyrus, according to Xenophon, said, well, father, it's to reward those who do well and to punish those who fail to do so. In other words, the old carrot and the stick approach. Now, I understand this was written actually about 2,300 years ago. And Cyrus's father said, well, yeah, that'll work in a lot of situations. But in some, especially in life and death, they may not. But there's a much better way, that will work. And so the young man said, "Well, father, what's the secret?" And the father said, "Simply," he says, "to treat those individuals that you're responsible for, and look after them better than they can possibly look after themselves." Now, what a simple thing! And it's today we talk about post-heroic leadership. Well, this was heroic leadership. You know, they talk about servant leadership. Well, this was servant leadership, and it was 2,300 years ago. So Xenophon really was a great author, and I eventually, on Drucker's recommendation, read Xenophon. And these are the things that Peter drew from the past. Peter was a great reader of history, and as you mentioned, Confucius and Xenophon and others. And he drew these nuggets from them and express them in such a way that we could understand. And Drucker wrote what we should do. He wrote, these different things. He predicted, as I mentioned, he predicted this great recession. And he said the cause of this recession that's coming, which came, like I say, this was 40 years ago. He said our chief executives of organizations, of companies, are making several hundred times the amount that the lowest level employee. He says, this is grossly an error. This is terrible. And he used examples like the military. He says, for example, a top general, a four-star general, makes about 17 times what a private makes. He said, and here these executives are making 200. Well, today, by the way, they're making 300 times of the most junior people. And he says, this is wrong. This is a terrible thing. But he said, management itself isn't just at fault. He said, so are the unions. He said, unions are expected every single time they go for negotiations, right or wrong, the compensations and the salaries and everything, the compensation of workers and the benefits are expected to increase. And he said, yet there's no talk about increasing their productivity. He said, these two things, because of this, we're going to pay a terrible price for this. And of course, that's exactly what's happened, what got us into this. I mean, he also believed, by the way, that he was one of the first to recommend that boards of directors should include members of the unions on the boards, because he felt that they're part of the organization also, and they have to be responsible not only for the rules of the organization, but also for their costs and what comes out of it.
Absolutely, and I think lots of times people don't understand. They honestly don't understand. And I'll go full circle to what you said earlier. People can make choices, and they're going to go someplace else. Here in the state of Washington with Boeing, right now, there are literally thousands of people in this state that are very upset because we had the machinists union that said, no, we're not going to accept the contract. And I wasn't there. I didn't hear the discussion. But the feedback that I've gotten from various people is that we can't take Boeing for granted. Sure enough, Boeing said, we are not going to be under the thumb of extortion by the union. And they put out a request, who's interested, and 15 states are competing. So what's happening here in the state of Washington is there's an entirely different group separate from the union that says, wait a minute, why are we going to force a company out of our state that has benefited us? It's affecting tens of thousands of people's lives. Why are we going to disengage because of this small amount of thinking that's going on here without any consideration of the overall effect? And I think that it's, in many ways, it's been very good because people are saying, what are we going to do here? How can we work with this? How can we still get engaged? But Boeing said, we don't need this anymore. We have been talking about this 15, 20 years, and nobody's paying attention. And now they've got all of these other states that are saying, we'd love to have you come and join. This is something that I often think people get stuck. They don't have an openness to become aware, and they don't know how to look at a bigger picture because there's an indoctrination that has been going on for so long. They think this is the only way it is. We're not living in the 40s. We're not living in the 50s. We're not living in the 60s. We're in the 21st century. The world is a different place. We've really got to see some big changes. And I'm so impressed with this book about Drucker, the practical Drucker, because it brings us full circle back to the reality. We are responsible. And I really liked the qualities of leadership that he brings out and how important it is. There's seven deadly sins that you talk about in the book. Pride, lust, greed, which you've addressed, laziness, anger, jealousy. And if you're going to be a leader, you really have to think. A leader isn't someone that goes out and just runs a marathon and goes, ho, 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 look at me. I've got this sign on my back that says I'm a leader. You have to live it. You have to demonstrate it. You have to be an example to the people that are around you. And this is something that you bring out. And I love the story about Alvin C. York. Gary Cooper was in a movie that portrayed
this man. Mm-hmm.
And it was so significant. But that is really that simple story. And there's stories today of people that are doing the exact same thing, but they're not getting acknowledged for it. They really don't care. They're just being who they are. But that about Sergeant York, I think he was a sergeant, and I just think...
Yes, eventually he was. I mean, he wasn't when he performed the act, but he was promoted later.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's just absolutely wonderful. Now, let's talk about heroic leadership. Drucker had a very significant attitude about this. What is heroic leadership?
Well, it's really putting others, sort of like a duty you have. And the duty is that you put your people and the mission ahead of yourself. And I don't want to sum it up in too short of a verbiage, but, essentially that's it. It's doing the right thing. For example, Peter said that, a leader can make a lot of mistakes and be wrong, and people will forgive him or forgive her. But the one thing that they will never forgive is a lack of integrity. And so integrity is so critical. So the leaders have really sometimes enforcement organizations, and we talk about leadership, and people say, well, other people in the organization don't work that way, and that's not my organization. And that's the bad thing, because you can actually have a climate of good leadership in which leaders are doing the right thing. They're looking for they're out for their people, and they're looking out for the mission first ahead of their own interests. And organizations were just the opposite, where when a leader arrives, he or she thinks, I have arrived, and therefore I have a mandate. I can do whatever I wish. It's my, what I've earned from getting promoted or however, becoming a leader. And that's wrong. That's really wrong. Mm-hmm. And so we have a lot to, as far as leadership, I think Drucker finally realized that it was his duty to translate all these things. He couldn't simply say that Xenophon, wrote these things 2,300 years ago. He really had to make it clear what it meant in today's world, and use examples from today, and that these are things that leaders in every single occupation that we have, in business absolutely, because Peter started out primarily being a corporation helper or consultant. But he went on to expand it to everything. I mean, heads of state and everyone else consulted him. And he realized that no matter what we're doing, whether we're in politics or whether we're in medicine or whether we are in manufacturing a product or whether we are a small business person, it didn't make any difference that these traits were all the same, that we, as leaders, we have to put the mission of the organization first, and then we have to put the people before our own. And that's the only way you can operate.
By the way, I want to ask you, I know we're going to be taking a break in a couple of minutes. Would you stay with me another 15 minutes?
Sure.
Wonderful.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, before we go to break, I wanted to share a story. And for those of you who are just joining us, the practical Drucker, applying the wisdom of the world's greatest management thinker, my guest is William A. Cohen. He likes to be called Bill. I adored this one story. I just loved the psychological basis of it. And it's something that you heard, and I've got to share it with my audience. This shows you how someone who is a good thinker will take a moment and will be able to utilize it. There was a woman who was on a suspension bridge who wanted to commit suicide. And the police come out, and there's a police officer who called to the woman to try to get her to come down to, not do this. He tried logic. It didn't work. Not at all. This I loved. I just absolutely loved it. He tried to order her down. That didn't work. And the woman was, they knew she was going to be going off. And this is what he did. And I loved this. He said, "Lady, you can jump if you want, but I sure wouldn't want to jump into that dirty water. It's full of sewage and garbage, and it smells awful." The woman looked down. She said, "No, that's not going to work." Got off of the bridge, and they were able to take her to safety. I thought, this man was a genius. He didn't try to.
Well, he kept trying, too.
Yeah.
You know, leaders don't give up.
I love that story. I loved it.
Thank you. Yeah, I did too. Leaders keep trying. They don't give up. They keep working until finally something works. They don't make the excuse, "Well, they won't let me do this," or "I can't do that," or "This is a problem," or whatever else. They just, great leaders go on to do things that ordinary people just won't do.
And I just love that story.
Thank you.
So if ever you find someone wanting to commit suicide, don't try logic. It's not going to work. Appeal to what maybe is going to get their attention in a different way. But the story is so appropriate. I mean, it's just getting that different application, and the lessons in it are really significant. Now, I know we're going to be taking a break for just a moment. When we come back, we're going to hear a story about integrity. And this is significant because this is one of the issues that our entire nation is seeing publicized, issues of integrity that are really very significant, and we have to hold people accountable. But we're going to find out about a particular person. His name was Hamlin Ham Talent. He was a naval flight officer. We're going to find out more about this story when we come back. This is Donna Sebo. My guest today is William Cohen. He has consented to be with me a few minutes longer. The Practical Drucker. We're going to find out how these applications can apply not just in business. These are standards that they work in everyday life. You don't have to think that you just have to be in business. This is quality of character, standards, and it would be something that'd be great to teach to youngsters as well. Donna Sebo here. We're taking a break. We're going to be back in just a moment. Don't go away.
Do you have a group, organization, or club that would like to have an interesting and dynamic speaker? Then you're going to want to have Donna speak to your group. She motivates audiences towards personal empowerment, giving them tools for their personal and professional success. If you would like Donna Sebo to bring a presentation to your next event, call Delphi International at 253-582-5604. That's 253-582-5604.
Do you have a product or service that you would like people to know about? Internet radio is a powerful medium that can assist you in reaching people who like to shop online and pass by electronic word of mouth information about you, your products, and or services. The Donna Sebo Show reaches around the world, and you can be part of that enterprising network. For more information, contact Vision Broadcasting via Donna at DelphiInternational.com
or call 253-582-5604. That's 253-582-5604.
Hi, this is Donna. Welcome back. We are talking with William A. Cohen. The Practical Drucker is the title of his book, Applying the Wisdom of the World's Greatest Management Thinker. This is about ethics, integrity. It covers so much subject matter that I think can make a big difference, not just in your life, but in the lives of people that perhaps you come in contact with. And I want to welcome you back, Bill. Bill,
Thank you. Let's talk
about ham. And
okay.
That's not the pork. That's the person.
But definitely not.
And then also Herb, because these
All
are
right.
two stories that I think are very significant.
Okay, yeah, Herb is a little bit, we'll get to Herb in a minute. But yeah, Ham was, Talent was a naval flight officer, and he was a commander of an F-14 squadron, it's a fighter squadron, and as in many organizations, especially in the military, they tend to compete for different awards. Now, their awards don't involve money or anything in the military, but they involve, in this case, I think, they had what they called a Battle E Award. But the point is, in Hamlin's story, the squadrons that were competing were cheating, some of them. And that is, they were indicating certain flight hours and things were logged, and they were not so. And he refused to do so. And his people said, look, there's no way we can win unless we cheat. Everybody cheats. We've got to cheat. We've got to do this thing. And he just said, nope, we're not going to do it. Now, you might think, well, okay, but it had a happy ending, right? And they ended up, no, they didn't win. The cheaters got the award. But really, that wasn't the end of the story, because if you look forward, in Ham's squadron, over a 20-year period, almost every single pilot in that squadron but other squadrons that cheated, they left the Navy for one reason or another. I mean, either they did something screwed up, or they left for more money, or 10,000 other different reasons. But in Ham's squadron, almost every single individual stayed with him. And so good leaders under Ham's influence, he influenced all kinds of future leaders through the Navy and from that our country. And Hamlin himself, by the way, even though he did not win this award, he went on to become an admiral, senior leader in the Navy, even though that 20 years earlier, his squadron, because they didn't cheat, didn't win this award. So that's a significant thing I think we have to remember. And I have to say this, too. If you would have asked Hamlin, he's not here now, but I would bet money if you said, well, what if you never became an admiral, though? What if because you didn't cheat, that never happened? Would you still have done the same thing? And I would bet every single penny I have, he said, absolutely. That was the right thing to do. So that's Ham's story. Now, he was a Navy guy. Now, Herb's story is different. And it's a personal story. And I put the name Herb on it because it's very difficult sometimes for me to talk about myself. This was not a combat story, by the way, but I'll tell you, it tried me a lot more than combat. It was when I was a new lieutenant, and I was on a B-52, a SAC crew. And I was with a number of other my crewmates were all very experienced. My aircraft commander was a lieutenant colonel, had flown in World War II with a lot of combat experience. The co-pilot was a senior officer. I mean, he was a senior to me anyway as a lieutenant. He was a captain or a major, and he had been around a lot and flown in Korea War and so forth. And then the electronic warfare officer, also another major. I was one of the two navigators. I was a navigator, and I flew downstairs with a navigator bombardier. We called it in the cellar down in the lower part of the aircraft. And the fellow I flew with was also a lieutenant colonel, had flown in World War II, and he was actually the bombardier. And we were both dual trained. I was a navigator. Now we got a new missile system. This occurred back in the early 1960s. It was called the Hound Dog missile, and it was nuclear tipped. and it was an extremely important weapon for us. And we got graded in B-52s in every single thing we did, and our advancement and everything else depended upon our ability to get our bombs on the target, to take off on time, and to make sure our navigation legs were correct. Everything had to be perfect. And the missiles, though, we just, you know, they were a new system, and for whatever reason, they gave us about 6 months how to learn how to use these things. Nobody was doing very well with them. I mean, we just weren't getting there. They were being scored. They're scored, by the way. We don't really launch the missiles. That would have been millions and millions of dollars. What we did is we went to a simulated launch mode, and then and they could grade these from the ground because the missile would say when it was supposed to dive into the target, and on the ground and radar, they could grade where it was supposed to hit. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't working out. So I was on alert with my crew. And the other member, by the way, was our gunner, who was a master sergeant. He also was a serious combat veteran, but he didn't play in this particular what happened next. At any rate, our aircraft commander, the lieutenant colonel, called us all together. And I was a young lieutenant just out of, I graduated West Point, went through flying school, and there I was about 2 years later in my early 20s. And he said, look, he said, we've got missiles when we get off alert. We're going to fly a training missile mission, about a 13-hour mission, with missiles. And for the first time, these missiles, what the scores are will actually count for everything, for our promotions and so forth. Now, he said, I don't want to hear anything discussion about it. He said, we're going to cheat, and the only thing I want to know from the navigators is how we're going to do it. Well, I was sitting there shocked because I went, you know, I'm a West Pointer. We don't lie, cheat, or steal, or tolerate anyone that does. And it was, I mean, I really literally was in a state of shock. The senior navigator, the lieutenant colonel, said, well, that's easy. He said, what we'll do is I'll figure out different ballistics, and we won't follow Bill's missiles, you know, that when we the navigator program these missiles to make them accurate and that be programmed in the air. He said, we'll follow I will bomb the target by radar, not really bomb it, but the radar system will break the tone, not his missiles. And because I figured out different ballistics, they won't know that on the ground, and they'll be accurate. We got off alert, and I had the worst time of my life. I mean, we typically were on for a week. We got 3.5 days of crew rest, and those 3.5 days were horrible, just horrible. I mean, I really didn't know what to do. I mean, I asked a couple other lieutenants what we should do, and they said, "Oh, they cheat like this all the time. Don't worry about it. Just go ahead and do it." And I just, you know, was on. I was lost. Well, I got called back early for another navigator who got sick. I was on alert, but my crew came out with me. I was only on for a day to plan this mission. So when they came out there, the name, by the way, of Herb will become more significant in a minute because I referred to it in a book I wrote some years ago as Herb when the first time I talked about this incident. But at any rate, we went out there and I asked if I could speak to him in private. He said, sure, Bill. What do we? I said, well, I could go in a room in private. So we went there, and I said, sir, I said, if you want to cheat on these missiles, you go right ahead, but get yourself a new navigator because I'm not going to do it. And I mean the wrath of God descended upon me. I mean, here was a old, crusty lieutenant colonel, been in combat, everything else. I had never been in combat in those days or anything, and was brand new, and I was telling him, refusing to obey it, and a direct order. And he yelled, and he screamed, and he did everything. He threatened me in every way he could think of. And he said, well, I'll have the lieutenant colonel so-and-so, you know, the guy I was flying with, the other navigator, do the. And he said, well, that's fine, but you'll have to have him sign for it also because I won't sign for it. So he was furious, and he left the room, and he slammed the door, and it felt to me like the whole building was shaking. And in those days in our flying suit, I used to smoke heavily, and I reached in my flying suit, and I barely managed to lit up a cigarette, and then went out, and I thought, what am I going to do in life? I mean, I was raised in a military family. I didn't know anything but the military. I had an engineering degree from West Point, but I really didn't know anything about engineering. Knew nothing about nothing, as a matter of fact, except for flying and being in the military. And I thought, boy, this is the end of my career already. and that's the end of that. And so I went through the motions of the flight planning as best I could. I mean, they were all around the navigator, and so it was important that I get involved in it. But after about an hour, he said, "Lieutenant Cohen, I want to talk to you privately." Notice that he didn't use my first name. So he went in this little room there, and he said, "Okay," he said, "I've thought it over." He says, "We'll do it your way, but those missiles better be reliable." And I said, "Sir, I'll do everything I can to make them reliable, except I'm not going to cheat." And at any rate, we as it happened, the missiles were reliable. And for some years, I thought, boy, you know, I have the magic touch. What a great navigator. And then as I got more experience, I thought, boy, I was just absolutely lucky. That's all. And by the way, we found out finally what the problems with missiles was in maintenance. It wasn't in the aircrew problem at all. I mean, they finally figured how to get the things working right. But at any rate, so after a couple of years later, I thought, well, I was just lucky. And then finally, as I became older and more experienced yet, I thought, those two old lieutenant colonels, I didn't know anything. They probably figured some way to cheat anyhow without me knowing. And maybe that's why they were reliable. But it was critical for me because after that happened, I knew how far I would go for what I believed to be right. And the answer was all the way. And because I knew that, other people knew that as well. Now, I said mentioned the name Herb because I wrote this book, and I felt very uncomfortable about telling first-person stories. And so in the foreword to the book, I indicated that a number of the people that I interviewed preferred to be used, to have a pseudonym used, not to use their real name. So I felt perfectly ethical in doing that, so I used the name Herb. But I told this story one time in a speech, and I told it as a first-person story. And one guy came up to me with kind of strange expression on his face. He says, "You're Herb." And I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, I read your book, and you said Herb did this thing. But you used it in the first person." He said, "First, I was really angry. I said, here's a guy talking about ethics, and he's stealing Herb's story. But you were Herb." I said, "Yes, that was." And so since then, I try to remember, don't use the word Herb. You know, whenever I can, use the real name. Just say it was you. So that's the whole story, but I got to tell you, I've seen that kind of thing in industry also a lot. You got to do what's right, even if it costs you. Maybe you won't become an admiral, or maybe you won't become a general. I was fortunate also. But it's still, you got to do the thing that's right, the right thing to do. It's right for the job, it's right for the people you work with, it's right for the people you work for, and it's right for the country. And that's true no matter whether you're delivering groceries or whether you're flying B-52s.
I think that really is something that goes right down to the positioning of ethics. I think it has an application of trust. That is something that is so desperately needed. And I love this. I'm going to pull this out of the section social responsibility. The term social entrepreneur is a buzzword right now, and I know we're just about out of time, but I want to close this out by saying, five of Drucker's major thoughts regarding what a corporation should do, and actually this is relative to all of us. You've got to be socially responsible. Number one, don't leave it to government. Number two, the corporate mission comes first. Three, there's an unlimited liability clause. Four, there are unique ethics of social responsibility. Five, there are opportunities for competitive advantage inherent in being socially responsible. I think that these are all components, and there's so much more. Bill, to your book, The Practical Drucker, Applying the Wisdom of the World's Greatest Management Thinker. William A. Cohen has been my guest today. He's got a website, the California Institute of Management, and that is gocim.org, or you can go to stuffofheroes.com. So there's two websites you can go to, gocim.org. and stuffofheroes.com. Bill, thank you so much. This has been just a joy, and there's so much more in this book. I really think it's a wonderful read. Thank you for being my guest today.
My pleasure and my privilege. Thank you so much, Donna.
This is Donna Sebo. We're taking a break. When we come back, more good things to share. We'll be back in just a moment.
Have you ever had a paranormal experience? Such as seeing a ghost, having precognitive dreams, out-of-body experiences, or other happenings. If so, Donna would like to hear from you. She's putting together a book of 100 stories from people who would like to tell their story. If you'd like to submit yours, send an email to Donna at DelphiInternational.com. Again, send your story to Donna at DelphiInternational.com. Be sure to include your contact information as well. Thank you.
Do you have children between the ages of 3 to 10? Do you love children's books and collect them? Then you'll want to know about God's Kiss, the award-winning illustrated children's book that has been enjoyed by families around the world. 15 beautiful illustrations by Pacific Northwest artist Ed Gedrose accompany this lovely story about a little boy named Johnny that will capture your heart and mind in a very special way. Multicultural and non-denominational in content, it will become a family favorite that you and your children will want to read again and again. This book is available by itself through Amazon, or if you contact me, Donna Sebo, directly, you can get a personalized signed copy. There is also a talking book. You can order the talking book CD by contacting me via email, donna@delphiinternational.com, or by calling 253-582-5604. You can also visit my website, DelphiInternational.com, to see more details. God's Kiss is a family classic that belongs in everyone's library. Get your copy now.
Hello, and welcome back. This is Donna Sebo. Telephone number, if you'd like to give me a buzz, is 888-627-6008. I welcome you back. I have a couple of stories that I wanted to share. By the way, if you'd like to chat with me, just give me a buzz, and all I need from you is your first name or your initial. And then after that, you're welcome to ask me a question about anything that you like. I just was so impressed with the information that my guest was talking about, because I think that as individuals, we need to know that who we are is what we live with all the time. And what I've found in my many years of working with people and in my own life, if you're not comfortable in your own skin, your life can be pretty miserable. And when you don't have integrity with yourself, you're really going to be a very unhappy camper. I don't care if you have a gazillion dollars or 2 cents to your name. It doesn't make any difference. Being comfortable with who you are is so important. And having that integrity with yourself is so important. Because as he said, when you are aware of what is most meaningful to you and you hold true to that, there's a strength with that that other people draw upon. It is so easy to go another way. And I think of various incidences in my life, one of which, and this is going to be in my book, Destiny's Mask, that I'm hoping to bring out next year, it was an experience, a very personal experience, and I learned this lesson when I was 19. And I was going through some very, very difficult times in my life, and there was a person that was literally terrorizing me. And I'm not saying that lightly. I had been advised that this person had intent of causing me physical harm, that they were talking about doing this. And this came to me from more than one source. And that is frightening. That is really, really terrifying. Because this person was perfectly capable of doing it. And one of the things I had to learn to do was to think through how I was going to manage it. And this person had been in my physical space and then left that environment I was in and had gone out of state. This is when I was living in California many years ago. And I can remember being relieved because that person was out from my area. And this went on for about 7 or 8 months. Boy, I was feeling fine. Person was not in the space. They'd gone a different direction. But then one day I was at work, and a fellow colleague said, Donna, XYZ is back in town, and I want you to know about it. I can tell you my stomach just went into turmoil. I was a wreck, and I thought, I have a choice here. I was only 19, I either have to face this person, or I'm going, I don't know, I can't run anywhere. I guess I could have. But I took on the strategy of saying, I want to know where this person is. I want to know what they're doing. I want to know exactly what's happening, and so I am going to face this person. And I did. And what was very interesting is that I watched, I observed, I listened, I asked questions, sort of put myself in a quiet role, and I found out a lot of information within a very short period of time. I then took the action of letting everybody around me know that this individual had meant to do me harm, physical harm, and I would just appreciate it if they saw this individual anywhere around to let me know. And you know what? What I learned was this. There are times that you have to face what is in front of you. Become aware of the good, the bad, and the indifferent. Educate yourself. Then make decisions based on facts and information, not to let your emotions come in the way. And believe me, my emotions were all over the plate of life. I was just terrified. This person did not get that perception. So I was able to assess what I needed to assess, and I employed other people with that keep me aware positioning. And eventually, as much as they tried to move into the space that I was in, they were not able to gain entry ever again, and no harm was ever done. But there was one day when someone called me and said, "This person is out walking around looking for you." And I stayed where I was. They said, "Do not go out. They do not know that you have moved." I did not go out. I stayed quiet. And by golly, the person was frustrated and disappeared. They could not win. Sometimes you have to look at your strategies, what you're going to do in life, but you have to take the positioning of personal responsibility and say, I have to let those around me know what I'm dealing with and facing what the reality of what needs to be done and taking the action necessary, whatever it might be. It's so important for me to share some of these things with you because you need to know that where you are, who you are, is very significant. You must have integrity with yourself. And there's always going to be some situation that is going to be challenging to you that you're going to have to deal with. And one thing that I learned from that experience when I was 19 years old is that you're not really alone. People are always wanting to help, but they have to know that you need help. There are so many cases in life when we feel like we just totally need to isolate ourselves, and that is not a good thing. Sometimes we need help, and we need to ask for it. Other times, we have to be decisive on what we're going to do if we have to take action, make a decision that is going to create the change that we want to see demonstrated in our life. We have to own up to that. We have to make it okay. But we have to stand true to our own character and come from a positioning of not letting fear govern what our decisions are. My guest today, Bill Cohen, he made that decision. He was threatened by an officer. All kinds of things came down. And yet one thing that evolved out of it that he didn't mention was the fact that this officer, this commanding officer, would have trusted him with his life because William A. Cohen was willing to stand true. And that is what enables him to achieve the recognition for what he did. It may not have been written up in a very special way, but credibility, integrity, and honesty really go a long way. This is Donna Sebo. Remember always, we're out of time. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. I'm so delighted you were able to join me at my broadcasting table today. We've got so many wonderful things to share. Brian Haggerty is going to be with us tomorrow. Put that cell phone down and look me in the eye. We're going to be talking about technology, its pluses, its minuses, but more than anything else, about communication and how important that is to all of us in everyday life. I'm so glad you were able to join me. Tell your friends about the show. We will be back with you tomorrow. Same time, same place. Bye for now.
You've been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. We're delighted that you were able to join us and invite you to tell your friends and family about the program. Have a wonderful day.